On this March 31st, this is Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio, also available as a podcast. I'm Steve Scully. Here are some of your Wednesday headlines. In Pittsburgh late this afternoon, President Biden unveiling a $2 trillion infrastructure plan centered on fixing roads and bridges, expanding broadband internet access, and boosting funding for research and development. To pay for it, the White House is proposing a higher corporate tax rate. We'll have details just ahead. Pfizer announcing its COVID-19 vaccine is safe and effective, 100% effective in preventing the illness in teenagers ages 12 to 15. The vaccine, which is given in two doses 3 weeks apart, is already cleared for emergency use to those over the ages of 16 and up, and the company planning to request emergency use authorization to those 12 to 15-year-olds in the coming weeks. All of this coming as the CDC announcing that COVID was the third leading cause of death last year. And in other news, a Democratic candidate for Congress from Iowa's 2nd Congressional District today dropping her challenge in a race she lost by 6 votes. And it's day 3 of the Derek Chauvin trial in Minneapolis. Just some of the stories shaping Washington today. It's all ahead here on C-SPAN Radio. We begin with President Biden, who is in Pittsburgh this evening, just weeks after signing into law a $1.9 trillion COVID relief bill. The president is proposing a massive investment in our nation's roads and bridges. The White House is describing it as a second phase of a two-part economic plan that will be debated in Congress over the next several months. There are progressives in the Democratic Party who say the plan doesn't go far enough. Republicans are critical of the price tag and higher taxes. We begin with the president in Pittsburgh earlier today.
So today, I'm proposing a plan for the nation that rewards work, not just rewards wealth. It builds a fair economy that gives everybody a chance to succeed, and it's going to create the strongest, most resilient, innovative economy in the world. It's not a plan that tinkers around the edges. It's a once-in-a-generation investment in America, unlike anything we've seen or done since we built the interstate highway system and the space race decades ago. In fact, it's the largest American jobs investment since World War II. It will create millions of jobs, good-paying jobs. It will grow the economy, make us more competitive around the world, promote our national security interests, and put us in a position to win the global competition with China in the upcoming years. It's big, yes. It's bold, yes. And we can get it done. It has two parts: the American Jobs Plan and the American Families Plan. Both are essential to our economic future. In a few weeks, I'll talk about the American Families Plan, but today I want to talk about the American Jobs Plan. I'll begin with the heart of the plan. It modernizes transportation infrastructure, our roads, our bridges, our airports. I just left your airport. The director of the airport said we're about to renovate the airport. Is that right, Mr. County Executive? We're going to renovate. We're going to employ thousands of people. And she looked at me and said, I can't thank you enough for this plan. It grows the economy in key ways. It puts people to work to repair and upgrade that we badly need. It makes it easier and more efficient to move goods, to get to work, and to make us more competitive around the world.
The president earlier today in Pittsburgh, and we learned that he did have a conversation with Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell about the plan. But Senator McConnell and other Republican leaders remain critical of the $2 trillion price tag, calling it an anti-business tax and spend package that likely will become the second proposal that the president will push through Congress using the reconciliation process. Meanwhile, the ranking Republican member of the House Ways and Means Committee, Kevin Brady of Texas, saying that the spending proposal amounted to what he called an economic, quote, sugar high that would boost U.S. corporate income tax rates to 28%, which would be among the highest in developing countries, also worse than China's 25% corporate base tax rate. But the president today defending the price tag.
The American Jobs Plan will lead to a transformational progress in our effort to tackle climate change with American jobs and American ingenuity, protect our community from billions of dollars of damage from historic superstorms, floods, wildfires, droughts, year after year. by making our infrastructure more secure and resilient, and seizing incredible opportunities for American workers and American farmers in a clean energy future. Skilled workers, like one we just heard from, building a nationwide network of 500,000 charging stations, creating good-paying jobs by leading the world in the manufacturing and export of clean electric cars and trucks. We're going to provide tax incentives and point-of-sale rebates to help all American families afford clean vehicles of the future. The federal government owns an enormous fleet of vehicles, which are going to be transitioned to clean electric vehicles and hydrogen vehicles right here in the United States of America by American workers with American products. When we make all of these investments, we're going to make sure, as the executive order I signed early on, that we buy American. That means investing in American-based companies and American workers. Not a contract will go out that I control that will not go to a company that is an American company with American products all the way down the line and American workers. And we'll buy the goods we need from all of America, communities that have historically been left out of these investments. Black, Latino, Asian American, Native Americans, rural, small businesses, entrepreneurs across the country.
We carry the president's speech live here on C-SPAN Radio. It's also available on our website. Among the items getting the fiercest criticism from Republicans, raising the corporate income tax rate from 21% to 28%, and a doubling the 10.5% minimum tax paid by U.S. multinationals. On Fox News this morning, these comments by Texas Senator Ted Cruz.
This has been an administration of the government, by the government, for the government. The only thing it appears they're in favor of is more government spending, more taxes, and more government power over your lives. And across the country, millions of small businesses are hurting. We've had a horrific year with a pandemic, with Democrat officials mandating shutdowns, with millions of small businesses shutting down. And now Joe Biden wants to come along and jack up taxes on all those small business owners, yep, destroying jobs. I got to say, his going to Pittsburgh is particularly ironic. It really is a thumb in the eye of working men and women. He's going to Pittsburgh because he started his administration the first week by ending the Keystone Pipeline. With a stroke of a pen, he destroyed, yep, 11,000 jobs, including 8,000 union jobs. And he announced he's reentering the Paris Agreement, which will destroy, again, hundreds of thousands of jobs, mm-hmm, across this country. Blue-collar, working-class jobs. You know, Joe likes to say he's from Scranton. Well, the people from Scranton are getting the short end of the stick with the government hammering energy jobs, oil and gas jobs, manufacturing jobs, steel jobs. Yeah. Any job where you're working on the line making something, your job is getting a lot more in danger because of Joe Biden's giving in to the radical left.
Senator Cruz made his comments earlier today on Fox News, and joining us from Los Angeles is Robert Kroll. He is a professor emeritus of economics at California State University, Northridge. He's also a scholar for the Mercatus Center at George Mason University in Northern Virginia. Let me begin with the price tag, $2 trillion. When you see that number and hear that number, what's your reaction?
It's a big number. We are throwing around trillions of dollars like they are what used to be millions or billions. So it's a very large, very ambitious, and very complex proposal that he has, the administration has put together. I'm a little concerned about overreach and maybe wishful thinking. Simply increasing funding to agencies and programs doesn't always give you the outcomes that you want. Just look at some of the problems we've had with the COVID relief. So we're seeing very dramatic increases in debt taking place in the U.S. and actually globally. Last year, just in the industrialized countries, I think governments borrowed about $18 trillion. These are some really big numbers we're throwing around here. And I'm not sure how much globally, financial markets are willing to absorb and buy, but I guess time will tell.
Let me go through a few aspects of what we're hearing from the administration and heard from the president earlier today in Pittsburgh. First, improving roads and bridges. You're in California, where the car is still king. Is it needed?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. I've actually done a bit of research on the quality of roads and bridges in the United States. The Department of Transportation has very detailed data on road conditions and also condition of bridges. And I think the administration is painting a much gloomier or more negative view of the conditions of roads. When I look at the data, I basically see road conditions in the U.S. over the last 15 years fairly stable. Our interstates have actually gotten better. For bridges, I think the president has been saying, about a third of them are in poor shape, and that's just simply not true. It's probably my calculations for 2019 indicates only about 6% of all bridges are in poor shape. And the other interesting thing is that there's, across states, something like 82% of the states, bridge conditions have actually improved over the last 5 years. So I think they're painting a bit too gloomy of a picture. I assume part of that is to market the program, but I think we should be cautious in that we need to maintain our roads and bridges. The infrastructure is very important, but I think we need to be careful in terms of how much we spend and how we spend it.
What about the issues of broadband and also dealing with climate issues?
Okay, with broadband, now, that's not an area that I work in, but I do understand that there are certainly certain rural areas where I just don't think it's that profitable for the private firms to install the broadband. So there might be a role there. And I think it's also important when we think about how the delivery of medicine is changing with telemedicine, that sort of thing. Rural hospitals may not have all the specialists that an urban hospital might have. And so I think you can make a better case for that, both in terms of, in terms of the health care and also in terms of the kids, in terms of their education out there. I think you can maybe make a case for that.
And finally, the issue of high-speed rail, a debate that is obviously front and center in California and other parts of the country, and also improving rail travel.
Yes. If you follow the saga of the bullet train in California, it's been a struggle. When you look at around the globe, if you look at these massive sorts of infrastructure problems, even when you're trying to contract to private firms, what you tend to see is a significant and consistent overestimate of use and an underestimate of cost. And the bullet train is just a classic example of that. The project keeps getting delayed. The costs keep going up. It's a very expensive way of trying to facilitate transportation. And I would sort of back away. I'm not really a fan of the bullet train ideas. Actually, just the construction creates a lot of CO2 emissions as you disturb the soil. So I'm kind of negative on pushing high-speed rail. The jet airline for most longer-distance travel is just far superior.
One final point, though, because President Biden had said on this issue, quote, China is eating our lunch. Do we need to invest more to remain competitive when it comes to transportation infrastructure?
Well, we want to be careful about how we read China. It is true. Let me back up for a second here. When we think of the United States and other highly industrialized countries, we've built airports and roads and that sort of stuff, throughout the 20th century and certainly during the post-World War II period. Now, clearly, we need maintenance. And certainly in certain cities that have been growing rapidly, airports may need to be expanded. But we certainly don't need to go out and build another 10 major airports. We don't need to build another interstate highway system. We have those things. We need to maintain them. China is still a developing country. And, if we go back 10 or 15 years, they had probably almost little or no infrastructure. So it doesn't surprise me that they're trying to build more roads, more airports. Also, a lot of those airports and a lot of those roads are empty. They're building a lot of infrastructure, and it's questionable about the wisdom of some of those projects.
Robert Kroll is joining us from Los Angeles. He is professor emeritus at Cal State, also a scholar for the Mercatus Center at George Mason University here in Northern Virginia. Thank you for your time.
You're welcome.
At the closing bell on Wall Street, the Dow losing 85 points. The NASDAQ rose more than 200. The S&P was up 14 and a third. Now to Minneapolis and day three of the trial of former police officer Derek Chauvin. Over the last 3 days, jurors have heard from 11 witnesses. And today, one of those witnesses describing what he saw in the early moments of George Floyd's arrest last Memorial Day. The testimony from 19-year-old Christopher Martin. He was a store clerk inside Cup Foods. The arrest took place just outside the store. And he was the person who took the counterfeit $20 bill from George Floyd, the incident that led to the call for police to come to the scene that brought Derek Chauvin and the other officers to that location.
Now we'll stop right here, please. Can you describe for the jurors then what we're seeing, what's going on there in that segment of the video?
That was when one of the co-workers kind of grabbed up the other co-worker and brought him back inside, and I was just yelling, like, chill out, chill out, chill out.
And so when his co-workers came to get the young man in the white T-shirt, he went with them back into the store.
Correct.
And you were following them?
Correct.
All right, so let's continue to run 33 then. Now, I want to pause here for a moment, please. For the record, 829.04, can you tell the jurors what happened, what you were doing here, I guess?
At this point, I think I was just kind of emotional, and I went to the African-American that was standing there in the curb, and I was just like, they're not going to help him. This is what we have to deal with, so.
Okay.
Sustained. Yeah, be stricken.
That's fine. So you had a conversation with another person standing there.
Correct.
And when you walked up there, we saw just before I stopped it, there was a young girl there in a green shirt. Did you see her when you were walking up there?
Correct.
You remember seeing her in the store earlier?
Correct.
Did you know who she was?
No.
And you remember being the cashier when she was in the store earlier?
Correct.
And then can we continue to run Exhibit 33, please? Now I'm going to pause here for a moment. The record should reflect 829.55. We saw you standing there with your hands on your head for a while, correct?
Correct.
What was going through your mind during that time period?
Disbelief and guilt.
Okay. Why guilt?
If I would have just not taken the bill, this could have been avoided.
That testimony from Christopher Martin. He was the clerk inside the store, initially calling the police to the scene in Minneapolis. At times, another witness, 61-year-old Charles McMillan, taking off his glasses and wiping away tears as he recounted the events as they unfolded, what he saw, the events that led to the death of George Floyd.
You okay?
Yeah.
I know that this is difficult. Can you just explain sort of what you're feeling in this moment?
I can feel helpless. I don't have a mama either to understand him. My mom died June 25th.
Hang on just one second, Mr.
Let's take a 10-minute break.
And that from the judge in just one of the many moments in the case that we've carried live on the C-SPAN networks. And, of course, you can watch it online anytime at cspan.org. The testimony involving Derek Chauvin at the trial in Minneapolis. He is the former police officer facing charges of second and third degree murder and manslaughter in the death of George Floyd. The CDC is out with some new numbers on coronavirus. The pandemic was the third leading cause of death in the U.S. last year, contributing to about 16% increase in the national mortality rate from 1 year earlier. Now, the virus was the contributing cause of more than 370,000 deaths in 2020 across the U.S. Only heart disease and cancer were more deadly, and COVID also displacing suicide as one of the top 10 causes of death in our country. Native Americans, Hispanics, and African Americans had the highest rates of COVID-19 death by race and ethnicity. With more on the numbers and what it means, CDC Director Dr. Rochelle Walensky.
Since early in the pandemic, COVID-19 has disproportionately affected certain groups in the United States, particularly Blacks, Hispanic and Latino, and Native American communities. In mid-February, CDC released its estimates of life expectancy in the United States in the first 6 months of 2020, which showed a profound impact on communities of color, with a drop in life expectancy of 2.7 years among non-Hispanic Blacks and 1.9 years among Hispanics, historic and tragic declines in these populations. Today, CDC is releasing an MMWR that provides additional detail on provisional mortality in the United States for all of 2020, with a focus on deaths associated with COVID-19. In 2020, about 3.3 million deaths occurred in the United States overall. This represents a 16% increase in deaths from 2019. COVID ranked as the third leading cause of underlying cause of death after heart disease and cancer, with approximately 378,000 COVID-19 deaths, accounting for roughly 11% of all deaths in the United States in 2020. COVID-19 deaths were highest for older adults and males, and were higher, as we previously saw, among American Indian and Alaskan Natives, Hispanics, non-Hispanic Blacks, and non-Hispanic Native Hawaiian and Pacific Islander persons compared to non-Hispanic whites. In fact, among nearly all of these ethnic and racial minority groups, the COVID-19-related deaths were more than double the death rate of non-Hispanic white persons. Sadly, based on the current state of the pandemic, these impacts have remained in 2021, where we continue to see that communities of color account for an outsized portion of these deaths. The data should serve again as a catalyst for each of us continue to do our part to drive down cases and reduce the spread of COVID-19 and get people vaccinated as quickly as possible.
That briefing that included the CDC director, Dr. Walensky, and Dr. Anthony Fauci joining the conversation, he commented on the newest vaccine, AstraZeneca.
I believe you're referring to the NIH statement that followed the letter that was sent by the DSMB to AZ, as well as with a copy to me. I did not have a statement questioning their data at all. I urged them to make sure that their data was up to date in the sense that the DSMB had written to them a rather harsh note saying they did not believe that the data that was in their press conference was the most recent updated data. The only statement that we made in our release was to encourage them to work closely with the DSMB to make sure that the data that they put into their press release is the most update and accurate data. So I didn't question their data at all. I just urged them to work closely with the DSMB. And I'm sorry, your second question?
I think the second question was related to variants, and I can just sort of fill you in. B.1.1.7, we know from our most recent data, is about 26% of circulating virus right now. We are looking at it by region. It varies in region from 4 to 36-35%. And so we're watching this very carefully, but it is starting to become the predominant variant in many U.S. regions.
I think your final question was asking us to consider whether the FDA was going to grant an EUA. Obviously, we're going to leave that to the FDA, but I'm wondering if, Dr. Fauci, you have any additional comments given the data that you have seen relative to the AstraZeneca release.
Well, the data that they made public most recently indicates to me that this is a good vaccine that is going to have a very important role in the global response to this outbreak.
That update from Dr. Anthony Fauci and others from the White House, the regular Wednesday briefing on coronavirus. Meanwhile, it was supposed to offer insights into the origins of COVID-19, but since its release yesterday, the long-awaited World Health Organization investigation has drawn criticism over claims it is incomplete and lacks transparency. In a joint statement, the United States and 13 other governments, including the UK, Australia, and South Korea, expressing concerns over the study's limited access to, quote, complete original data and samples. Earlier today, we spoke to Dean Chang. He is an expert on China for the Heritage Foundation. I began by asking him why he questions the results of this report.
This is one of those Ronald Reagan trust but verify moments. And in the case of the Chinese, they have provided us with very limited means of verification. The Chinese, by their own reporting, if you look back in January of 2020, were saying about how they hadn't followed their own pandemic control guidelines and reporting requirements. They then didn't cooperate with the WHO back then. And with this most recent report, they were very carefully controlling where the WHO team could go, who they could talk to. I liked one description that said that we had this image of Sherlock Holmes out there with magnifying glasses and swab kits, and that was not actually what happened. So we know the Chinese conceal a lot of things, and unfortunately, COVID has been one of the things that they've been pretty clearly concealing a lot of details, even from their own people.
What about the process by the World Health Organization and those investigators on the ground trying to get answers? Did they get what they needed?
Almost certainly not. We have several problems with this. The first is, of course, the extended timeline for sending the WHO team in the first place. So by the time they got there, for example, the wet market had been pretty much sanitized by the Chinese. Second of all, we have questions about some of the people involved from the WHO side, people who had financial and other interests in China, whose companies had, for example, worked with the Wuhan Institute of Virology. If you're going to do an audit of a company, having a member of the corporate board serving as one of your auditors would probably raise some questions. That seems to have been the case with the Chinese. And then, of course, from the WHO team's own statements, they got into shouting matches in some cases with the Chinese over what they had a right to access. This was not a wide open investigation. So there, you know, who was doing it, when they were doing it, how they were doing it. There are some serious questions about every one of these aspects.
You have also been critical of President Biden, who agreed to rejoin the WHO early in his administration, shortly after taking office. Why do you think that was a mistake?
So President Biden rejoining WHO without the WHO reforming any of its actions. I mean, considering how the WHO, for example, ignored warnings from Taiwan, members, senior members of the WHO literally walked off of an interview because they were being asked hard questions by journalists like yourself about, hey, what about these Taiwanese warnings? Why were they ignored? We've seen no evidence that the WHO has restructured itself, reformed itself, tried to actually be more open to outside information. To walk back in and say, here, how much money do you want? Here, we'll put our faith and credit to support yours, seems kind of foolhardy and certainly not a very good negotiating tactic. I mean, walk in and say, how much money do you want when you say you want to buy a car? Guess what? The car dealership is probably going to take advantage of that.
We're talking with Dean Chang. He is a research fellow for Asian Studies at the Heritage Foundation. I guess what I'm hearing you say is that this report is leaving more questions than answers. From your perspective, will we ever find out what really happened in terms of the origins of coronavirus?
So one of the interesting things was an anthrax outbreak in the 1970s in the Soviet Union, which turned up when people looking at census data suddenly noticed a lot of Russian towns had literally just disappeared. And for years, the Russians claimed that the Soviets claimed that there had been no outbreak and it had been a natural outbreak. And when the Soviet Union finally collapsed, it turned out that there had been a weaponized anthrax outbreak. I want to emphasize, we have no idea whether COVID was a bioweapons or not. In fact, most of the people who analyze this, who are actual virologists, say it's not. But what I'm trying to emphasize here is that the truth does eventually come out. And what happened in Wuhan, what happened in China, whether it was a natural crossover or whether it was a accidental release from a research facility, I think eventually the truth does emerge, but often it's very delayed. How much effect will that have on treating what is still a global pandemic? That's much harder to say.
More details at heritage.org. Dean Chang, a senior fellow for Asian Studies, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
And welcome back. This is Washington Today. I'm Steve Scully. Here are some of your other headlines. Two Capitol Police officers suing former President Trump in federal court, alleging that he is responsible for the mob that stormed the U.S. Capitol on January 6th. Nearly 140 D.C. and Capitol Hill police officers injured that day. The Pentagon is eliminating the Trump-era policies that largely ban transgender people from serving in the military, issuing today some new rules that offer them wider access to medical care. We'll have the details still ahead. And Microsoft signing a contract with the U.S. Army to develop augmented reality headsets, which will be used both in the field and for training purposes. These headsets would provide night vision, thermal vision, and other sensors. In politics, Rita Hart, the Democratic candidate for a U.S. House seat in Iowa, announcing today that she had made the decision to withdraw her contest before the House Committee on Administration, that effectively ending her bid to overturn the results from last fall. She lost the 2020 race in Iowa's 2nd Congressional District to Republican Marionette Miller Meeks by 6 votes. She had asked the Democratic-controlled House to investigate the results, including 22 ballots that her campaign argued should have been counted that would have flipped the results in her favor. The House does have the ability to investigate and possibly reject the election results. The chair of the committee involved, California Representative Zoe Lofgren, issuing a statement saying, quote, "I understand that candidate Rita Hart has withdrawn her contest. The contest before the Committee on House Administration was proceeding under the Federal Contested Election Act, which requires a contestant. There being no contestant, there is no longer a contest. The committee will accordingly recommend that the whole House dispose of the contest and adopt a dismissal resolution." That update from Iowa's 2nd Congressional District. And more on that Justice Department investigation into Congressman Matt Gaetz over allegations involving sex trafficking and prostitution, including involving a minor. Federal investigators are examining whether the Florida Republican did have a sexual relationship with a 17-year-old girl. It was during an interview last night on Fox News with Tucker Carlson that the lawmaker denying the allegations and claiming they are part of a larger extortion plot against him and his family.
Yeah, again, I only know what I've read in the New York Times. I can say that actually you and I went to dinner about 2 years ago. Your wife was there and I brought a friend of mine. You'll remember her. And she was actually threatened by the FBI, told that if she wouldn't cop to the fact that somehow I was involved in some pay-for-play scheme, that she could face trouble. And so I do believe that there are people at the Department of Justice who are trying to smear me, you know, providing for flights and hotel rooms for people that you're dating who are of legal age is not a crime. And I'm just troubled that the lack of any sort of legitimate investigation into me would then permute, would then convert into this extortion attempt.
I don't remember the woman you're speaking of or the context at all, honestly. But I would like to know who. So they're saying there is a 17-year-old girl who you had a relationship with. Is that true? And who are they? Who is this girl? What are they talking about, the New York Times?
The person doesn't exist. I have not had a relationship with a 17-year-old. That is totally false. The allegation, as I read it in the New York Times, is that I've traveled with some 17-year-old in some relationship. That is false, and records will bear that out to be false.
How long has this investigation been going on, do you know?
I don't know.
When were you first informed of it?
You know, again, I really saw this as a deeply troubling challenge for my family on March 16th when people were, you know, talking about a minor and that there were pictures of me with child prostitutes. That's obviously false. There will be no such pictures because no such thing happened. But really on March 16th was when this got going from the extortion standpoint.
That with Congressman Matt Gaetz with Tucker Carlson on Fox News last night. The investigation did begin during the Trump administration by the Justice Department, continued now under the Biden administration. The House Republican leader, Congressman Kevin McCarthy of California, calling the allegations serious. He was in Iowa earlier today making these brief comments.
Thank you very much.
What about Representative Gaetz?
What about?
There's talk of him in allegations regarding a young girl.
There's talk of
that position of leader. Are you still supporting him? Are you talking to him about it? Where do things stand right now from your point of view?
There's a New York Times story that I read. I haven't been able to talk to Mr. Gaetz yet. Mr. Gaetz denies the story, but I look forward to talking to Mr. Gaetz. I haven't heard anything from the DOJ or others, but I will deal with it if any of it comes to be true.
Should he remain
Thank
in his seat?
Much.
Thank you.
That from Congressman Kevin McCarthy of California in Iowa earlier today. And in a statement on Twitter last night, Congressman Gaetz, as you heard earlier, denying the allegations first reported by the New York Times, claiming his family has been victims of a $25 million extortion plot, adding, "No part of the allegations against me are true." Meanwhile, Indiana Senator Mike Braun saying that the border issue is what he calls an unmitigated crisis and described the system as gamed because of claims that immigrants are sending money back to get more family members across the border. All of this coming as the Biden administration looking for ways to house children while urging migrants to stay away from the U.S.-Mexico border. Here's more with the Indiana Republican.
Hey, Senator Mike Braun, down on the southern border outside McAllen, Texas. This is a holding site where you can see the conditions here. And in the 2-3 hours since I've been here this evening, found out that we've got illegal crossings at an all-time high under the Trump administration before President Biden gave an open invitation to come across. We are at 45-year lows, but the humanitarian conditions here, it's appalling. When you think about smugglers bringing people across the border, charging $4,000 per person, and all the trials and tribulations you've got coming from the Northern Triangle up here, this is the end result. And unless something is done, it's going to get worse. I'm talking to the Border Patrol agents, morale is at an all-time low. It's doing well when we had stay-in-Mexico policies. And what is happening here, I think the American public needs to take a look at, because it's a travesty.
And that from Senator Braun, he posted it on his Twitter page. And on Air Force One en route to Pittsburgh earlier today, the Deputy White House Press Secretary asked about the situation on the border, including those children, many who are between the ages of 9 to 16.
I wanted to ask one question on the immigration front. Reporters did just get into one of these detention facilities, and the conditions were pretty bleak. It's at, I believe, 1,700% capacity. Is there a plan to alleviate this overcrowding, and by what point should conditions down there be better?
Yeah, as we have said repeatedly, you know, a Border Patrol facility is no place for a child. And we have been working around the clock in coordination with HHS to quickly move unaccompanied children out of these crowded Border Patrol stations and into the care of HHS so they can be placed with family members or other sponsors. We even put the OOR staff and HHS embedded into CBP to make this happen, to expedite that process. We deployed FEMA to help HHS quickly build additional capacity to shelter unaccompanied children. We also developed and deployed a plan for HHS to more quickly place unaccompanied children and families members. We are seeing progress, but it's going to take time. But let me be clear, we are putting out the message, the border is not open, people should not make the dangerous journey, and we will continue to expel individuals and families.
Those comments from Karine Jean-Pierre, she is the Deputy White House Press Secretary, speaking to reporters on Air Force One. Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny starting a hunger strike in prison to protest officials' failure to provide proper treatment for his back and his leg pains. In a statement that he posted on Instagram, Alexei Navalny complaining about prison authorities' refusal to give him the right medicines and allow his doctors to visit him behind bars. He is also protesting the hourly checks that the guards make on him, saying it's amounting to sleep deprivation. Navalny said in a statement that he had no choice but to protest with a hunger strike because his physical condition has worsened. He said his back pains have spread to his right leg and he feels numbness in his left leg. Meanwhile, UN Ambassador Linda Thomas-Greenfield delivering remarks in New York and speaking about China and Russia. This is what she had to say.
Actually, my question was on China and Russia, so I have a follow-up. On personal level, did you find a good relations with the ambassadors from China and Russia? And did you have the feeling that there are, the chances of building a good relations, at least on some common ground that you just mentioned? Thank you so much.
Yeah, I mean, I really look for those areas where we have commonality and try to promote those discussions. And in areas where we have differences, and there are a lot of those areas, you all know what they are, we don't pull any punches. You saw that during the meeting in Anchorage that the secretary held, and in my discussions with the Chinese and my public statements, you've seen we called out the Russians on Syria, and we called out the Chinese on the genocide that is happening against the Uyghurs. So, again, we know that we have to work together, but we also know that we can't... I can't give them a pass where there are areas that cause us major concerns. And that's particularly on the area of human rights.
That assessment from Linda Thomas-Greenfield. She is the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, the 31st U.N. ambassador representing the U.S. Well, the Pentagon today issuing new rules that transgender people serving in the military, offering them a wider access to medical care and assistance with gender transition. The new department regulations allowing transgender people who meet military standards to enlist and to serve openly in their self-identified gender, as they will be able to get medically necessary transition-related care authorized by law. This is a reversal from what we saw during the Trump administration. Here is spokesperson John Kirby at the Pentagon.
Now, I think you all remember back in January, the president issued two executive orders impacting departmental policy with respect to transgender individuals. Executive Order 13988, which is entitled Preventing and Combating Discrimination on the Basis of Gender Identity or Sexual Orientation, and Executive Order 14004, entitled Enabling All Qualified Americans to Serve Their Country in Uniform. In response to those executive orders, the department immediately issued interim guidance to hold in abeyance any adverse personnel actions initiated under previous departmental policy and directed the identification and review of records of any member involuntarily separated, discharged, or denied reenlistment based on gender identity. This effort, this review effort, is ongoing. The department also identified and initiated revision to two DOD instructions that affected the military service of transgender individuals. DOD Instruction 6130.03, Volume 1, is entitled Medical Standards for Military Service, Appointment, Enlistment, or Induction. And DOD Instruction 1300.28, which is entitled In-Service Transition for Transgender Service Members. Now, today, the department is announcing the publication of revised editions of these two instructions. The revised policies in these instructions restore the department's original 2016 policies regarding transgender service. Specifically, they prohibit discrimination on the basis of gender identity or an individual's identification as transgender. They provide a means by which to access into the military in one's self-identified gender, provided all appropriate standards are met. They provide a path for those in service for medical treatment, gender transition, and recognition in one's self-identified gender, and they seek to protect the privacy of all service members and to treat them with dignity and respect at all times.
That from John Kirby, Pentagon spokesperson, earlier today, and we have posted that on our website. A reminder, this program, it's available as a podcast. Be sure to sign up so you never miss an episode. I'm Steve Scully for the Wednesday edition of Washington Today, hoping you enjoy the rest of your evening.